Following Martin, the assault team once more formed up in a wide, intervaled column and made its way up through back streets alongside the posh shopping district the Galaxy had called Triangle Square. It was still called that on the battle boards and Takan maps, except now it was a battlefield. A few more savage sentries had been silently disposed of, and within minutes the team was watching from inside the dark shadows of a high-end restaurant that had been dark since that day 6 weeks ago, when the savage ship first came out of the skies above the gleaming gem of a city. Across the street stood the ancient First Bank of New Vega, a literal fortress, or literally the remnant of one. Back before New Vega City was even a city, the early colonists had guarded their fragile wealth from the pirate cartels here in this central fortification, in this blocky, triangular, 20-story-high building. There were no windows below the fifth floor, and a well-defended entrance provided the only way in. One heavy machine gun team was bunkered in front of the entrance at ground level, and two more had taken reinforced positions on the second floor in stone architectural balconies that, ornamental or not, seemed hardened to withstand attack. All savage forces were clearly oriented to engage anything the coalition threw at them down the main street, Grand Avenue. In 5 minutes, Ogilvy would order his armor and remaining infantry forward at slow speed, using maximum cover. From the west, Captain DeMacha and his three tanks, with a platoon of infantry under the command of Lieutenant Maydoun, would attack into the triangle and absorb the attention of the leading savage elements located along the eastern side, bunkered in glitzy stores and fashionable high-rises that formed multi-tiered garden grottos. With the eastern side of the savage defenses engaged, and the southern end of the triangle attacking the coalition forces coming from the north along Grand, the colonel's team would then assault the main entrance of the bank, from an angle that was roughly behind the heavy machine gun team stationed at the entrance. After breaching the door, they'd engage and clear the savage defenses located within. It was hoped that the savages would react defensively once the bank, the anchor of their defenses, came under assault. If they were forced to refocus on the threat from within, or even tried to retake the building from without, the savage units would stop engaging Ogilvy's troops, allowing them to take Triangle Square. Or at least that was the plan. Sergeant Major Andres was sweating when he checked his watch. It was hot. Outside, the last of the day's zenith of heat was fading, but not so within the quiet dark of the abandoned restaurant. He checked his watch. 2 minutes. "Everybody up," Andres said. He may have been scared to death, but there wasn't an ounce of fear in his voice. "Come on, pretty boys. Nap time is over. Time to earn your pay and kill some savvies. After this, fortune and glory. And maybe your mamas can buy a new forge printer with the life insurance they're gonna get if you don't come home." No one laughed. They'd seen enough of their comrades die to feel like their luck was out, that to keep fighting was to tempt fate just one time too many. The reality of their pending deaths weighed in such a way that no amount of levity could lift it at that moment. Weapons had been checked and loaded. Triggers were live. Gear was shucked or tightened. But there was no laughter. The work was quiet and businesslike. At 1 minute, everyone was staged in two-man teams to exit the building. They'd move forward, covering angles and engaging. Objective one was to neutralize the ground-floor machine gun nest at the entrance to the building. In the distance, coalition armor, probably sentinels or wolverines, opened up at range. The powerful booms of their guns could be heard echoing throughout the canyons of the city, shattering windows, shaking tables, and forgotten dinnerware. A few shots smacked into the bank several stories up and did little more than send forth sprays of concrete. The savages' heavy machine gun teams immediately answered from across the square. They were sending armor-piercing rounds at the tanks, APCs, and the infantry on foot.
"At least that got their attention, sir,"
whispered the sergeant major over comm at 30 seconds to go. The colonel nodded once but said nothing. His gaze was out the door and on the machine gun nest down the street. It was barking on continuous automatic fire, and even from here, 40 meters across and down the street, bright brass flew out and away from over the sandbags. The savages' guns were gas-fed twin-barreled murder machines. To get caught in their deadly cone was to die badly in several places all at once. There was nothing from the colonel in the seconds before they moved. No words, no assurances, no hope. Everyone knew their job. To look at him was to know that he was going to do his job, and yours too, if you died trying. No one failed to notice the contrast of the quiet inside the darkened dining establishment, as measured against the maelstrom of death unfolding in industrial-sized doses out there on the street. These things were present in the minds of men about to run from one to the other. Except maybe the colonel. He seemed not to care about the weight of the moment. His eyes were cold and murderous. "Go!" shouted the sergeant major, and then they were breaking out from the restaurant. Running and not shooting, not until the last possible second. To their right, from some distant building, a lone savage sentry got on the ball quick and opened with a sudden staccato full burst, spraying the line of men running to engage the pit. Three went down in the street, including the medic. The rest kept running, moving as fast as they could to get across open ground. The colonel was fastest, flat out sprinting, his rifle bouncing in his hands with each stride, anything but at the ready. He was determined only to close the distance as quickly as possible. Other teams moved more slowly, following sights in, ready to engage targets. Still others were hustling to set up fire on possible enemy response avenues. Someone decided it would be good to fire at the sentry before he could shoot more men down in the street. That one hollow bark of the pulse rifle, ethereal and sudden, an alien sound amid the din of heavy machine gun fire, alerted one of the ammo loaders in the savage machine gun pit they were about to storm. One of the faceless savages, features covered by the dull gray surface of his helmet, pulled an old-school sidearm, a big old massive hand cannon, and fired at the colonel. The rushed shot went wide and smacked into another soldier. The colonel was already firing as his rifle came up. It was wild until he walked it to its mark and knocked down the savage with the pistol. Without slowing, he slammed his shoulder into the sandbag barrier that formed the sides of the pit. He could hear the team of savages inside reacting. It was alien almost, high-speed electronic chatter that sounded vaguely familiar. "Frag ready," he shouted at a trooper who'd come in behind him. Then he stood suddenly and sprayed pulse rifle fire over the barrier on full automatic, not even looking, just holding the weapon over his head and pointing it down on the other side. He ducked back down and screamed, "Now!" at the man next to him. The soldier had already cooked the frag like a pro. He popped up, dropped it onto the other side of the barrier, and dove onto his stomach. A moment later, the explosive rocked the pit, killing the savages on the other side. "Move, move, move!" shouted the sergeant major to the rest of the troops. Time for objective two. Breach the old bank. A soldier who hopped the barrier slipped in savage brains that had been blown across the pit. The twin-barreled heavy machine gun was a smoking ruin, and above, on the two armored and reinforced balconies, the other savage machine gun teams were still engaging coalition forces down the street, apparently unaware of the breach taking place closer at hand at that very moment. The colonel was distantly happy that they had a little surprise still going for them. However, the savages communicated, they hadn't realized the anchor point of their defenses was under direct assault. It was time to exploit that to the fullest. Infantry stacked on either side of the ancient security door. The thing was a massive chunk of reinforced steel that had once guarded the fortress from pirates with blowtorches, explosives, and firearms. "Do it now, sir," shouted the sergeant major once everyone was staged to follow on. One of the infantrymen rushed forward with a large two-handed canister. He studied the massive lock for only a brief hesitant second before rearing back with the single-usage lockbreaker canister and swinging it with all his might, activating the rail-driven depleted uranium ball within. The massive slug shot forward at incredible speed and destroyed the locking mechanism and much of the door, using relativistic force. The infantryman dropped back away from the door, tossed the spent canister, and pulled his primary while one of his fellow soldiers shouted, "Door kicker for the win!" Someone tossed in flashbangs, then grenades, and then they went in shooting at everything that moved. What they found on the other side shocked them. A savage reaction force of about 20 in dire black armor had been tasked with holding the security lobby. The flashbangs had disoriented them, They stumbled about, placing big armored gauntlets on walls or surfaces to stabilize themselves. But the frags had done almost nothing. Explosives that turned men to red goop and missing body parts, that generated the mechanically equivalent outcome when it came to light-skinned machines, mech sometimes, and even the heavy troops of some worlds that skinned in similar armor to the savages, that had killed all of the savages in the machine gun nest. But those same explosives had done far less damage to these savages. A few had smoking limbs that had once finished in the hand, or rather a gauntlet. These waved their stumps about. Another savage had been cut completely in half, no doubt due to an unfortunate proximity to one explosion. And a big one, an elite, as they'd been tagged by CIC battlefield intel, wobbled around with both massive gauntlets gripping its helmet. The rest of them bore only smoking fragments in their armor as they tried to regain their feet. Then again, none of them looked immediately capable of firing back. A few struggled for their weapons, but with little success. The Spallers and infantry, and even the colonel who'd followed the first of them in, after swapping out a new charge pack for his rifle, fired almost point-blank into the frozen and surprised savage quick reaction force. And every one of those soldiers noticed something as they burned through full charge packs, slaughtering their stunned enemies. There was no blood in the massacre beyond the ends of their stuttering barrels. Within seconds, the savages were dead, or rather, lying motionless in their armor, no longer struggling to reach their weapons. The biggest, the elite, was the last to go down. It had gone to its knees after taking several hits, yet stayed upright, almost defiantly, its massive giant gauntlet still clutching at its fractured and smoking helmet where the flashbangs had injured it, him, or whatever it had once been. Sergeant Major Andres, breathing heavily, sweat streaming down his chocolate skin, stepped over, pulled his sidearm, and put two pulse shots into the big giant's head. It crashed to the floor of the old bank security review entrance. Silence took over for a moment, though there was a full-scale battle going on just down the street. Smoke and burnt ozone lingered in the air. "Go three," Andres said, croaking out the words. The infantryman moved on to Objective 3 with business-like professionalism. Now it was time to wipe everyone out inside the building in teams. Get the savages to react to the threat close at hand, and fast, so that Ogilvy's forces could finally take the square. Colonel Marks could hear Captain DeMatch's sentinels rumbling into the battle. According to the plan, the massive tanks were coming down 3rd Street and firing high-powered anti-personnel rounds at close range into the savage defense on the eastern side of the square. The teams moved quietly on toward their assigned floors. If Savage Comm was down, that was the only explanation Colonel Marks had for how little resistance they had faced in taking the building. Then a little more surprise might help, not only with the mission, but with surviving long enough to link up with DeMatch's tanks. The colonel and Martin moved to take the roof and try to put down the indirect fire coming from there. Andres stayed to hold the entrance with a small team in case the savages tried to retake the building from the ground floor.
"You get overrun, Sergeant Major," said Marks as he stepped into the stairwell. "Let us know."
Meaning, if you're about to die, tell us.
"Ain't gonna happen, sir. Always wanted to own a bank, now I do. Ain't gonna let it go just like that. My mama would have thought she raised a fool or something."
The colonel smiled at this, which wasn't a thing he was given to.
"Hey, colonel,"
said Specialist Martin, standing above the body of the big elite that had been the last to go down.
"Come back and look at this before we move, sir."
The colonel stepped over. The giant had been hit by at least 30 pulses. The beautiful black armor, which up close seemed to have textures like circuitry whorls, and even braille-like dots along its surface that hadn't been observable from a distance, was ruined in several places. As with the other defenders, there was no blood running out onto the ancient golden tile of the bank. There was no burnt flesh or shattered bone, no intestines running out onto the ground like the colonel had seen in every other conflict with the savages so far. No gore. Nothing of the awful horror that bodies look like when they've been ruined by weapons. Fascinating and terrible in the same moment. When you're struggling to reconcile that the macabre corpse before you is a life with experiences similar to those of the one who took it. There was none of that. except inside the helmet of the dead savage giant, within its fractured fastness, were the remains of a human brain. The colonel stared at it, and for a moment it seemed to waver before his eyes, but that was in his mind. His eyes saw nothing more than the gray goo and spatter. But the waver had been his perception and reality meeting, his own mind not wanting to agree with the data it encountered. The savages were post-human. There was never any doubt about that. But once, long ago, they'd been just like him, with a brain just like his, just like all of theirs, surrounded by a body and humanity in all its messiness and beauty. The difference was, these savages had kept the brain and lost the body in their long night march toward perfection. The brain was the only thing left of what they once were. Chapter 26. A wild firefight inside the bank lasted for the better part of the next hour. At first, the savages weren't dialed into the fact that their line was under attack from so close. The heavy anti-armor fire coming from the bank/fortress was still focused on the surging main body of the coalition coming up Grand Avenue into Triangle Square. Captain DeMacha lost one tank in the charge down 3rd Street, but he kept most of the infantry safe. Firing from across Triangle Square into the savage-defended high-rises produced devastating effects on the structures the enemy was fighting from. But the savages never let up, even with rubble exploding all around them. They refused to be dislodged by effective crossfire. Ogilvy's main force of mixed mechanized infantry and armor support, struggling up into the square, could not link up with DeMacha's. No matter what they did, there was no pressing across the main square without taking heavy casualties. Triangle Square was a light show of tracer rounds, pulse fire, and the occasional sidewinding blur and following smoke trail of an anti-armor rocket. The assault bogged down as Ogilvy held up for 5 minutes and called for additional TAC air support before attempting the next push. During this pause, he departed the TOC in the rear and moved forward in an APC, Armored Personnel Command Car, to better direct the battle from closer to the units supporting the heavy fighting. The colonel was listening to all of this over the comm with only half an ear. Following Martin, his team was moving up the stairwell toward the roof. But by now the savages were aware of their incursion. "Better hurry up, Colonel," Sergeant Major Andre shouted into the comm, the concussive sound of pulse rifles filling the background. "Savages are massing across the street to retake the bank from the ground entrance."
"Roger."
At every landing of the stairwell, the colonel could see for himself the savage response. A wide central well bored upward through the first 8 floors of the bank, ringed by broad hallways with beautifully tiled floors and sculpted brass railings. Those opulent corridors were now lines of attack for savage teams advancing to stop the assault on the stairwell at one corner of the well. The resistance was fiercest on level 4. The entire team was stopped cold, engaged in a vicious firefight against a host of savages, not unwinnable, but certainly not something Marks and his men could speed through.
"Sir," a sergeant shouted to Marks, "you and Martin should move up. Get to the roof. My team can hold the counterattack."
Marks nodded after assessing the situation for himself one last time. Pulse rifle charge packs were quickly littering the impromptu fighting position. Short controlled bursts dropped savage Marines or sent them covering in office sprawls. Firing, targeting, and firing again seemed to be the only way to get a knockdown on the heavily armored savages. The Spallerzan infantry were adapting to the situation.
"All right, let's go," Mark said to his point man.
Martin led the way up into the next floors, following the barrel of his brutal assault pulse rifle into the shadowy dark above. 2 more flights up, a lone savage Marine came charging down toward them. Martin fired on full auto, drawing a line of pulse impacts across the wall, and then the savage shape-shifted from a man into that cartwheeling human-like spider and was suddenly flying toward Martin's head. Marks joined in the firing. The savage went limp, dead in midair, trailing ruined ceramic plate armor and bleeding hydraulic fluid trails. It smashed into the wall and fell to the landing with a thump. The colonel wasn't taking chances.
He stepped forward and put two pulses in its ruined helmet for good measure. The blue flash of the weapon turned his face suddenly stark as Martin watched and waited to make sure they were ready to go on. Like the colonel, Martin wasn't a talker. The merest of glances from either seemed to serve as an agreement, a plan, or a direction. They were a fighting team now. Rank faded away. The sprint up the stairs lasted all of two levels before the savages decided to blow the stairwell from above. The unexpected blast was like the loudest, dry stick that ever snapped, rising above the cacophonic chatter of assault and pulse rifle fire, reverberating through the gloomy shaft of this ancient fortress of a building. The war outside in the square to the north was completely drowned out. Marks felt the stairwell beginning to buckle beneath his feet. He grabbed Martin by the LCE and dragged him out onto the level's balconied hallway bordering the main well. A moment later, the entire stair collapsed onto the lower levels, a landslide that sent dust and debris flooding out in a cloud. Likely right on top of the boys they'd left behind on the fourth floor, unless they'd been able to push their way past the savage defenders. Just down the balconied corridor the colonel had escaped to, a savage machine gun team, firing from a leaded cathedral window that was now filled with smashed shards, looked over in surprise at the two invaders who'd appeared on their flank. Marks was already rolling over onto his belly. He dumped a full charge pack into the savage loader, who was in the midst of feeding a belt of massive rounds into the wicked-looking light machine gun. Brass links lay scattered across the floor. The first burst caught the savage full-on dead center. The thing merely sat down hard on its butt, a dozen smoking holes in its chest plate. Undaunted, it pulled its sidearm and began to fire back. The colonel had fired his pulse rifle dry, but Martin hadn't fired at all. He didn't kill the savage, but his spray of pulse rifle fire did manage to blow off the arm attached to the hand holding the thing's weapon. The sidearm went skittering off along the floor as arm and body parted ways. As if in slow motion, the savage merely looked at the missing limb and moved to pick up the weapon with the other hand. The savage gunner was dragging the powerful automatic weapon, likely loaded with armor-piercing rounds, from off the ledge of the massive window that looked down into the war-torn square. He hefted it around to unload on the two infantrymen. The colonel was slapping in a new charge pack when the interceptor Ogilvy had called in for an airstrike overshot the laser-designated target in the square below and unloaded a massive volume of pulse fire on the upper floors of the bank. Both Martin and the colonel watched in amazement and relief as the two savages were suddenly torn to shreds by the air-to-ground fire that swarmed in through the smashed window at the end of the corridor. It was lucky, but both men were happy to take it.
"Come on," muttered the colonel in the yawning silence that followed. "There's another set of stairs on the other side of this floor. Hopefully savages didn't blow them too."
Then they were up and moving, racing across the slaughtered remains of the two savages, the ruined heavy gun, and the piles of skittering empty brass casings as the fire from the strafing run licked up in small pockets of flame, burning out on the floor.
Chapter 27. Savages, incoming!
There were maybe 15 savage marines moving fast and covered by light machine gun fire from the buildings along the eastern edge of the square. The first force seeking to retake the bank. It was clear they intended to rush the entrance. Specialist McNeil, Private Herr, and Sergeant Major Andres alternated fire from the bank's smashed security entrance. The running, cartwheeling savages died halfway to their objective. "Colonel Marks," Andres attempted over the comm. "How copy?" In the fortress-like confines of the bank, the comm was going in and out. The sergeant major could reach some of the squads clearing the building, but he'd lost contact with Colonel Marks altogether. It was the senior NCO's conclusion that either the colonel had been killed or that something more than the building itself was interfering with comms. Maybe the savages were using some kind of sophisticated directional jamming equipment to isolate the defenders at the main entrance. He suspected the latter. Or maybe just hoped. Colonel Marks didn't seem like he was going to die all that easy. But in war, strange things happened. Amateurs got lucky, and incoming fire didn't discriminate.
They're coming at us again, boys, Andres yelled after dumping a charge on full auto to keep a savage's head down out there. I get killed, you hold this position with your lives. Is that understood? We can't have them cutting off the rest of our boys from escape if they need to pull out. Got me? Both soldiers, one checking the sights on his rifle, murmured their understanding of the standing order they'd just been given. About a minute later, a high-powered round, fired from some savage sniper weapon system out along the eastern side of the square, probably from back in the recessed dark of one of the artillery-smashed buildings, took off Private Herr's head. Or rather, it blew the back half off, leaving a red spray of mist hanging in the dry and smoky air, painting the rear wall of the security entrance in gray matter.
Oh, shit! McNeil shouted.
The sergeant major, who was crouching beneath her while the kid scanned the street for the next assault, caught the boy's body and lowered him to the floor. He knew the private was dead already. Time in grade and various hotspots had taught him thus. Stay back and watch, Andres told Specialist McNeil as he dragged Herr's body over toward the other side of the room, where it would be out of the way for the rest of the fight, where some recovery team would come and find him once the battle was done and all the savages were dead. He took the kid's weapon, charge packs, and remaining explosives. The rest of his platoon would need those. He quickly folded the young man's arms across his chest.
You just rest now,
Andres heard himself say from some distant part of his mind, his voice a wheezy gasp in the hot afternoon of this unending day. The other part of his mind, the present situation part, had been working the NCO's constant problem of supply and redistribution to care for those who remained, to get as many as he could home. He stopped when he heard himself. And then he decided that was okay, as long as he kept moving.
That's all right,
he whispered to himself, leaving the body and rejoining McNeil.
It's okay if you tell him it's over now.
That, too, is an NCO's job. Then he was back to the present and all its demands of attention, return fire, and constant supply. Another savage assault pushed from a building closer at hand. Near the restaurant, Team Ranger had initially assaulted from, firing as they moved. A heavy gunner at their center unloaded a brutal hail of gunfire at the entrance, while two teams spread out and rushed forward from the gunner's flanks.
Nades, young specialist, hissed the sergeant major with his hands out. Sense of urgency would be good right about now, in fact.
McNeil pulled a frag from off his vest and handed it to the sergeant major, who fluidly armed it and rolled it into the pit the savages were racing for. Then his hands were out for another. McNeil held it out and the sergeant major took it and waved the specialist back against the wall. The sergeant major waited, kneeling, one hand holding the fragger, the other with his fingers out and ready to arm it. The first explosive detonated and probably killed some of the savages as they swarmed the empty weapons pit. But their heavy gunner was still shooting, still moving forward slowly, raking the door with as much fire as he could place there despite the jumping weapon. He was smart. He was firing for suppression, keeping the defenders back from the entrance so the savages could get close enough to put their own grenades in play. An explosion in a tight, confined space like the security lobby would be more than enough to do the job. Andres bided his time.
Keep coming, you mother.
At the last second, the sergeant major tossed the grenade out the door and onto the front steps, hoping the savages were getting close now, hoping that after the first grenade, the savages would suddenly surge forward, seeking to seize the momentum. Recognizing that the window for another grenade was just bare enough for them to breach and spray the lobby, to get their kills and meet their objective. That's what Sergeant Major Andres wanted, that some lost human part of the savages might still be thinking, grabbing for moments of desperate survival and not weighing the odds, surrendering to time and chance, as though they were cosmic do-overs for the losers. The sergeant brought up his rifle and fired on the doorway without waiting for a target to appear. His pulses were already hurtling toward the doorway as the first savage filled the smashed frame of the entrance in its hulking faceless armor. Andre's pulse fire tore the thing's head from its torso. A split second later, the frag exploded violently and a little too close for comfort.
Ah! Damn it!
Andre shouted.
You hit, Sergeant Major?
McNeil yelled above the din of his own rifle firing. Andres felt a sharp pain in his chest and for a chaotic moment thought he might be having a heart attack. But when he pulled away a probing hand and saw it bloodied, he knew a fragment had struck his left pectoral muscle. He could feel it now, sticking out of muscle and skin. He grunted in agitation each time it brushed against his clothing and armor.
"I'm all right,"
he yelled back, sitting with his back facing the wall, watching the entrance.
"More are coming."
A savage stumbled through, missing both its arms, half its helmet sheared away, its brain smoking from within the ruin of its head. Sergeant Major Andres would remember that, could never forget it. The thing's brain, buried inside that faceless helmet, was on fire as it stumbled through the doorway. McNeil opened up and dropped it with a brutal burst from his pulse rifle, and they waited for more, and waited, but none came, for now. The plan had involved the colonel and fire teams reaching defensive positions quickly. The three, now two, soldiers at the entrance couldn't keep the savages at bay all by themselves. That wave had only been barely fought off. "Let me help you, Sergeant Major," said the specialist. "Hold on while I clear the door." McNeil stepped almost gingerly through the debris, hugged wall near the entrance, and checked the opposite side of the street from an angle just below line of sight and along the bottom of the entrance. Then he ducked and crossed to the other side of the frame quickly. He stood, carefully, and checked the street once more. The sergeant major distantly remembered that was not far from where her had been killed. Poor kid. But McNeil's head didn't explode. A second later, he was back to the sergeant major and assessing the wound. "Ain't bad, Sergeant Major. I can treat this." He pulled out his basic medical kit. "You just watch the entrance. Anything shows up, tell me to get out of the way and end it. Okay, Sergeant Major?" Andres felt cold and sweaty, but he managed to nod. He'd never been hit. 19 years in, and he'd never been hit. Don't that beat everything? McNeil worked fast, getting a clot shot in near the wound and stopping the bleeding. Then he pulled the shrapnel and hit the ragged tear in the sergeant major's skin with superplastic from a one-shot injector every soldier carried. Finally, he slapped a self-adhesive pressure dressing across it. The smart bandage ran through its diagnostic and turned green, indicating a good seal. "You want some chill, Sergeant Major?"
"Yeah," thought Andres distantly. "That'd be real good, 'cause this is gonna hurt like, well, like a..."
He stopped. He knew he was getting foggy, maybe a little shock. Checking out and getting evac might be nice, but not now. He had troops who needed him. It wasn't time to go home yet.
"Ain't got time for that, specialist."
"Good to go.
Help me get up."
The sergeant major used the butt of his pulse rifle to help get to his feet. His left arm didn't want to work, and he was afraid of tearing the bandage. That was something he didn't have time for either. Then comms went live, confirming Andres' suspicion that it was the savages outside the entrance that had jammed it. But before the sergeant major could check in on his men and the colonel, the coalition air boss, call sign Wizard Actual, gave a priority address across all channels. "Targeted airstrike inbound. Heads down on the ground." A moment later, the roar of inbound strike fighters off the Indomitable came in, weapons hot. They filled the street with as much pulse fire as they could lay down along their pass. It sounded like they were coming down the middle of Grand Avenue, shooting at everything as they blazed by before streaking off, roaring into the late afternoon smoke and haze.
"It's good to be infantry," said the sergeant major as he and McNeil fell back to their next position,
an inner office designed as a final bunker before access to the bank was granted. Covering behind concrete slabs that had been installed as barriers against the long-lost days when pirate merchant princes had blasted off with an entire planet's worth of cash and gems in their old pirate junks. The golden age of intergalactic piracy, someone had once called it.
"Infantry seems like a pretty lousy place to be this afternoon, if you ask me, Sergeant Major."
"Nah," said the old NCO with a wry smile. "My ex digs scars." On the other side of this, he wanted to look her up, maybe say he was sorry, maybe get another chance, or just show her his new scar and see where things went.
Chapter 28. The Wild Man, Hilltop District. The streets were empty and desolate, at least between the major battles and the smaller flanking skirmishes of both opposing sides, Savage and Coalition. Everything the Wild Man looked at appeared haunted, abandoned. Weeks earlier, this had been a thriving metropolis of close to 10 million. Now, it was lonely and forsaken. It reminded him of Stendhal. After the big battles the local militia had lost against the savages that had come out of the skies one rainy night. In the weeks after the street fighting back on Stendhal, the world that didn't exist on the stellar shipping lanes anymore, the savage haulers and heavy cargo lifters came in, carried off their stolen booty, looted wealth, plundered food, and loaded newfound slaves. The world became emptier and emptier by the day. The savages set up massive detention camps beyond the limits of the burning cities, remarkable in their sudden appearance and horrifying in their purpose. What few remaining forces of Stendhal's government in exile tried to retake those locations through guerrilla raids, often joined by bands of local militia made up of crazed family members or grief-stricken survivors willing to do anything on the chance that just maybe, possibly, their relatives might be in the next camp, might still be alive. Storming the wire at night had been standard operating procedure in those last moments. Doomsday klaxons and bone-white searchlights from the big ships winding up as the savage marines reacted to the incursion. Their reaction was to leave, to herd the desperate and captured aboard as the militia came through the wire in force. Then those heavy lifters and cargo ships, under fire and full of newfound slaves, climbed up into the night and disappeared forever, taking lost family members with them. He always told himself they'd been killed, that they hadn't been taken, that they'd been murdered by the savages. But here, in the silent quarters of ruined New Vega, where he'd come to fight the savages once again, he wondered, was that really true? Had they died in the fire that swept their township? Or had they too been taken up in the big lifters, burning for rendezvous with the savage hulk, hauling out of orbit and making for the dark between stars? Lost forever now. Lost. He wondered about wife and baby. It's got to be that way, he thought as he ran along the empty street, and under a shadowy arcade that must once have been filled with shoppers and tourists coming to the gem of this sector to see the latest shows and attractions, spending their vacations and accumulated wealth on a day they were supposed to remember for all the rest. Behind windows, smashed and unsmashed, lay all the luxury goods anyone could ever want. The Wild Man stopped suddenly and listened to the yawning silence that hung across this section of the city. In the distance, more savage artillery left the gun tubes. A moment later, it fell somewhere to the rear, on what must be the Coalition lines, because there was no one else, except him. Tall buildings rose up from wide, sprawling blocks of commerce and prestige in the streets ahead. Grand palaces of business towered over opulent hotels and once optimistic design and advertising firms. Farther down the street, one of these proud buildings had collapsed into the street, forming a great frozen wave of debris and wild beams. Coalition interceptors streaked through the sky overhead, tearing the air to atoms as they ripped across the heights of the tall towers. They'll come in soon to hit their targets, he told himself. They're just taking a high-altitude peak before they make their attack runs. He'd seen it all before. Seen it on Stendhal, the home that no longer existed. Seen it in other battles on other worlds where the savages had come to loot and plunder. Seen it on archival footage of past savage attacks, going back to what seemed like the dawn of intergalactic spaceflight. Only it was closer back then, those short jumps. Yes, he'd seen it all. Had seen them, the very real boogeymen who came out of the dark and carried away wife and baby. He was moving again. He didn't want to stay in the shadows of the silent arcade any longer. He needed to do another, needed to feel her smile once again at what he could do. Hear her.
Do another one, babe.
He needed to hear that. His massive rifle was held at port arms as he stuck close to the sides of the tall, silent, brooding buildings, making his way toward the fringes of the big conflict shaping up at a triangle of open space. From atop his lofty perch, raining down single-shot death on the savages that had the misfortune to enter the world of the scope mounted on the big rifle, he'd spotted that big empty triangle within the packed urban sprawl, an open grand plaza kind of space that Stendhal had never had the chance to getting around to developing. That lost colony world had been too new in the grand scheme of things. Everything had been utilitarian. Stendhal had been a hard world. But that triangle, grand as it was where the big fight was going to go down between the savages and the coalition. Both sides, whether they knew it or not, were committing everything to that small space. You just had to have a bird's eye view to see it, and to know what was coming from both sides. Like two storm fronts on the local weather radar when it was time to go out and round up the cattle to come in. You could see it all shaping up, and it put a nervous fear in your gut that was kind of electric and exciting at the same time. He wondered why the coalition with their fighters and orbiting ships didn't see it. But maybe they did. Maybe they wanted to have it out right there, fighting on battlegrounds of their own choosing. As he'd picked up the spent brass from around his last hide, he'd also seen the big walker, the mech the savages had deployed at the top of the hill, moving down along the streets, firing smoky barrages of rockets and rounds over the tops of the tallest buildings to land in the coalition rear. After losing a few fighters, the coalition had given up trying to take it down. They just took what the beast had to dish out, trusting in attrition to win the day. Two other walkers had also deployed from the belly of the massive savage hulk, and he was willing to bet that old ship was full of surprises, like a carny show come in to fleece the local rubes on a death-rattle freighter that didn't look so much like a spaceship as it did a junkyard in loose agreement with itself. In the middle of a side street, he found a dead UW soldier. Matte gray body armor, PDB Type 76 blaster rifle. He'd only been dead a few hours. Probably came in with the first wave to breach the no man's land, and either got separated or picked off by a drone. Probably the latter, judging by the look of the man's torn open abdomen. Despite the fresh gore turning putrid in the late afternoon heat, the wild man stripped the body of what gear he could find, mainly rations. Someone had taken the charge packs for the rifle and whatever explosives the man had carried. But he did find the comm that attached the dead soldier's helmet, and he quickly stripped that out too. He could hear unit chatter, tinny and small, still being exchanged. "Might be good to know what's going on," he thought to himself as he finished up. He looked around watchfully, guilty almost, then left the dead man in the street and headed off once more toward the battle. A few streets over, after the interceptors had streaked in and shot up the area, as he heard distant tanks rumbling forward, spraying death across their front arcs in tremendous booms, he found a suitable building, one that might provide a glimpse into the savage lines. He smashed the glass at the front door and let himself in with little fanfare. The lobby was dark and quiet, cool and paneled in rich dark wood. The carpet was plush, and there were big overstuffed leather chairs that would either rot with time or perish in a nuclear fireball if Tyrus Rex ever showed up and solved problems the way he tended to. And maybe, he thought, as he began to climb up through the dark stairwells of the building, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. Chapter 29. Command Tactical Operations Center, TOC, Coalition Strike Force Warhammer, 15 kilometers to the rear of Triangle Square. The TOC was jumping. Savage artillery pieces operating from Hilltop had struck the power generator vehicle, wiping out power. The truck was close enough to the TOC that everyone inside was buzzing with the adrenaline from the near miss. Supreme Coalition Commander Ogilvy was listening to his staff officers and shifting position in the mobile TOC that was supposed to follow the second echelon forces forward. "Sir," a staff officer said, his voice tense and his eyes fighting fear, "we need to shift back to the rear. We're too close to the lines." Several more of his staff nodded in support. to the point that Ogilvy sensed an outright rebellion against his command if he didn't move back. These staff officers weren't interested in getting killed the way the infantry, armor, engineers, and special forces were currently getting killed trying to take Hilltop. But the plan, Ogilvy's plan, called for him to follow the second echelon forward, and the Supreme Commander continued to feel quite strongly, in fact, that the optics of saying something devil-may-care and fighting on from closer to the fighting would play well come some future election. So at the moment, he was undecided about everything. Despite the moment-by-moment wholesale slaughter going down on the streets of New Vega, as far as he was concerned, this was all still movement to contact. The real battle had yet to begin. But this preparation, this throat-clearing, as he had come to think of it, was not going well. No less than 37 different operations were underway within the coalition umbrella, and all of them were going badly. The 247 sappers out of Epsovolk had disappeared trying to enter the bunker system beneath the old colonial district of Hilltop. The Spallersen Marines from off the Indomitable had missed their LOA and walked into a brutal crossfire halfway up Assault Axis Grand. Their surviving officer, a mere captain of all people, was reporting 70% casualties. Ogilvy scowled at the thought. That captain had clearly done something horribly wrong. The 9th UW Infantry, mechanized, had failed to take Triangle Square in the initial push, as had the 2nd Armor and the Rigelian Mech Lancers. All three of his heaviest assets were now stalled along the Grand Avenue assault corridor. A special operations unit assigned to knock out the indirect fire atop the anchor in the Savage Line had been shot down. Their helicopter took a direct hit and spiraled in somewhere down along 4th and Commerce. Drone recon confirmed total unit kill. The list of tragedies, which the general thought of as failures, failures that would be personally attributed to him in the history books, was growing rapidly. This was not good for his career prospects, but he coldly appraised his future ambitions and found they were still intact. The more devastating the battle, the more glory there was to be had when it came time for victory. A not distant part of his mind calculated that a win, in the end, would look even better not despite of, but because of all the casualties. "I know," he hectored himself. "I'm a true monster. But it's not all war. Sometimes it's politics, and I didn't make the rules. They were that way before I ever showed up. So just play the game, Augie." Play the game. Ogilvy held up a hand to the officer who'd pleaded for them to fall back. But before he could speak, an S-3, running overall combat operations for Warhammer, entered the circle of huddled officers. "Sir," said the S-3, "I need to advise you that we have an open option right now if we're going to knock out the nest without resorting to nukes." The general raised a droll eye, a look that he hoped said, "Oh, come now, it's not that bad, yet." But the sober look on his heavy-browed staff officer's face said that it was indeed that bad. Oh, bother. Staff officers are always so dire. That's ever their way. The problem with them, the general thought as the man began to lay out the seriousness of the current situation, is that they don't have vision. They don't see the grand picture, where all this is leading. And if you don't have vision, well then, you don't have optimism, and so the rest is moot. After all, he reminded himself as the staff officer went on and on about casualty counts on forward units, how do you think I got to where I'm at? "We can use the bombers to clear the square if," said the staff officer with a measured seriousness that communicated that he knew exactly what was in play, lives and careers, "if we pull back our forces now. The savages might wise up, but our Titan bombers, sir, are carrying Alpha Strike armaments at present. They'll crater that whole section of the city in one pass. On the other side of that, we can bring Strike Force Wrath into play and destroy the nest on the ground before she bugs out." Ogilvy bit his lip and studied the computer-rendered displays of the option he was being presented with. "Titans, you say?" He said this just for something to say, while he bought himself time to think about how this might affect his career. He wasn't thinking about the legendary UW bombers at all. He was trying to see how authorizing strategic bombing runs within the city limits of New Vega played out politically. And what he saw was himself in front of a committee trying to explain high civilian casualties. And that was the start of a slippery slope to war criminal status. The next Tyrus Rex. Do we have another option? He murmured almost to himself. No one said anything. Option two, he barked, knowing what it would be. The staff officer put the battle board down. He took a deep breath. Sir, he said stiffly. We pull back and evac the planet.
Then we release the nukes Wrath is carrying.
Absolutely not, screamed the general theatrically. I was sent here to save the planet, not annihilate it like that bloody Tyrus Rex. What do you want, for all of us to end up war criminals? And what, millions dead if the survivor counts are right? We're at nearly 50% casualties ourselves. What then? We head back home and say, sorry, we killed half the force and ended up using the nukes anyway? Not on my watch. The next one of you that even mentions that option, be aware that I will press field charges and will have you shot for battlefield treason if the fleet jag can swing it. Or, he glared around evilly, I'll do it myself and face the consequences on the other side of all this. He was aware that some spittle was hanging from his lip. He licked it quickly and felt, or rather knew, his face was florid. The staff officer swallowed hard and looked away, unable to make eye contact with the general. Good, he thought. Let them be more afraid of me than of the savages. Get me Admiral Sulla on the comm. Staff hustled to make this happen immediately. Astonishingly, the S3 stepped forward, alone. Not one other staff officer at his side. Ogilvy's mouth open for a verbal scourging that would be remembered long after he was gone, when the men in this room, his protégés, were in the twilight of their own careers. But the S3 spoke first. Sir, respectfully, I must ask what you intend so that I can send alerts for change of mission to the units forward. The general straightened his battle dress uniform, folded his hands over his knee, and fixed the officer with a grave look. Then he smiled pleasantly, once and quickly.
Why, dear boy, I intend to use Wrath and the bombers in tandem. We'll pin the savage forces forward and crater them, as you so eloquently put it. Then Wrath will hit the nest at the same time. Within the hour, we'll have solved this mess, and by dark we'll be in sweep-up mode. Problem solved. Without nukes.
The S3's face brightened.
Excellent, sir. Shall I send the orders for our forces to fall back?
Oh, no. We mustn't do that.
Sir, broadcasting a change of mission warning, ordering the forward units back, is the height of folly if the savages have broken in on our traffic, which is highly likely, given the rate of mission failures in ongoing operations. They cannot find out about the Titan Alpha strike, or they'll scurry back down into their holes. Sweep up would be hell, costing far more casualties in the long run.
The S3 stared at his commanding officer in horror, but he said nothing for several tense moments. And rightly so. This was no war to lose a career over. To be clear, sir, we will be unleashing the strike danger close to forward elements. Danger close. That was an understatement. Ogilvy nodded tersely. It's for the best. Chapter 30. Carrier Defiant, Task Force Wrath, Outer Edges of the Vega System. Admiral Sulla regretted the time away from the CIC, though it had been necessary. He'd needed to attend the briefing with Ogilvy's commanders on the ground, and felt it was equally important to visually inspect the task force with a flyby in the assault frigate Carruthers. But even these short engagements, followed by a flight off the planet and then a quick micro-jump out to the task force, had taken time he didn't have, time in which the entire operation seemed to be going to hell planetside. And now, as he walked into the Combat Information Center at the heart of the massive United Worlds carrier, he received an alert that General Ogilvy wanted calm immediately. The first officer of the Defiant couldn't control the roll of his eyeballs at this latest demand from their prima donna supreme commander. Sully gave the man a look that reaffirmed his position that rank was to be respected,
if not always the person on whom the rank was pinned. The chastised officer nodded and patched the comm through to the digital sand table currently showing the developing battle on Vega. On the board below Admiral Sulla's gaze were a lot of red enemy assets surrounding Coalition Blue. The picture did not look good at all. Real-time updates from the Explorer, a scout-class United Worlds corvette holding at suborbit over the battlefield, showed an operation turning from dire to grim. Sulla studied the continental map. The thing that bothered him the most was that they were having a hard time locking down a location on those savage interceptors that had jumped the initial insertion fleet. Attacking from orbit into Atmo, no less, which was a tech not currently available to the Coalition fighter craft, and specifically the premier military United Worlds fleet, the most ancient of all the starfaring navies, and still the most powerful. Atmospheric fighters and bombers had to be taken in by carrier, just as the Indom had done during the combat jump. She was now on station and out to sea at a kilometer above sea level, running flight ops against the savages protecting the nest. And yet, there had been no sign of those savage interceptors since... "Sulla!" shouted Ogilvy good-naturedly over the comm, as though they were merely old friends catching up and not commanders waging a losing battle about to go seriously sideways. The noise of the operations APCC sounded in the background. "Supreme Commander Ogilvy?"
"Good, good. Well, we're having a hard time of cracking this nut. Heavy casualties."
"So I see," murmured Sulla, turning away from his command staff, hovering around the digital sand table. He'd had higher hopes for this operation than the way this was going down. Many in the galaxy were ignoring the Coalition and Planetary Forces' successes in driving savage hulks away. There was fear at play, and that fear was leading the galaxy to think that perhaps Tyrus Rex and his ruined world tactics were the right way to deal with the savage menace. A convincing victory on a planet as infected as Vega would have gone a long way toward putting an end to that reckless and unsustainable strategy. But something had gone horribly wrong here. These savages weren't shoving off like they were supposed to, like they always did after their raids. Loot as much of the planet as they could before the Coalition, or whatever body, could get a force together to stop them, and then head off once more into the interstellar dark in their nightmare hulks, taking their prisoners with them. Slaves. And perhaps worse. Loved ones simply disappeared forever. The savage ships, massive things, were often never heard from again. Maybe they found a home. Maybe they were destroyed by a stellar anomaly. Or maybe their ancient ships finally came apart at the seams. Who really knew? Sulla knew. He'd been on one for 15 years. Few people still living knew that, just a handful, including the two other slaves who'd survived.
"So, what I'm thinking is that I see an opportunity here, Admiral," said Ogilvy, his eyes glinting.
"And what would that be?" asked Admiral Sulla, committing to nothing. Part of the deal he'd struck with the power brokers of the loosely confederated worlds was letting this idiot run things. The logical choice would have been someone else. A specific someone else. But that came with problems Sulla would have been unable to navigate. And Sulla ever worked behind the scenes to make things happen as a combined effort, because it had to be that way.
"I admit it may," said General Ogilvy after clearing his throat. "Look bad from Explorer's sensor feed, but examined in another light, there's a moment of opportunity here for us to seize the reins."
"Let's hear it then, General," said the Admiral a bit testily. "I'm sending in the bombers," announced Ogilvy. "Full alpha, coordinated, all the bells and whistles. Savages are committed to our line. No civvies on the streets. Intelligence believes the survivors are bunkered or, well, I'll be blunt here, that they're already inside the nest. With civvies out of the way for all intents and purposes, we realize the alpha strike and then bring in Wrath to hit the nest now. Immediately. Go with Beta 2 targeting solution. Cripple the nest's engines and establish a cordon denying liftoff." There was a long pause, static in the calm across the great distance of a solar system,
which itself was nothing more than an island in the dark sea of the galaxy. The Hypercom was still years from being a reality. The leading bleeding edge of intergalactic communication tech was Tachycom, boosted quantum, which meant it could feel like real time at this solar distance, but it wasn't. There was lag, and across the void between the stars, it was like sending an ancient Pony Express rider. It was during that pause that Admiral Sulla considered the general's proposal, that the general would pull his troops back before that strike was a given, meaning Sulla would have to determine what the true timetable of immediately truly was.
That seems a reasonable plan, I agree. When will your troops commence withdrawal?
This pause seemed longer than the last. Perhaps the distance between them, the mechanics of quantum. Or,
troop withdrawals are already underway. I need you to jump in just under 47 minutes. Can you do it?
The Admiral looked at the CIC clock, then the sand table, the represented death still proceeding at an industrialized pace. And still he said nothing. The plan had been to wait until the savages lifted off before engaging the hulk with a naval task force. Task Force Wrath. Wait until the savages had removed themselves from the planet. Less chance of contamination and infection. Less chance of the savages releasing whatever voodoo they might have cooked up in the dark. This route, by contrast, would destroy much of that jewel of a city, though the planet would at least be spared. All in all, it was something halfway toward the Tyrus Rex solution, which would make some people happy. What was being suggested by the desperate general, planet-side and on the ground, wasn't the plan. But plans went out the door the moment the shooting started. Always had, always would. And in the end, it would still end up proving Sulla's point. Rex's strategy of using trigger nukes to destabilize and ruin entire planets at the atmospheric level was not necessary. It needed to stop. And Sulla hoped what was about to happen would convince the bull-headed Rex of just that.
Agreed, he said. Starting the jump clock for 46 minutes to atmospheric insertion with Wrath. Stand by.
Chapter 31. Team Ranger, First Bank of New Vega, Triangle Square. The comm still hadn't come back online as Martin and Colonel Mark started assaulting the savages embedded on the roof of the old bank, firing short controlled bursts. After knocking out two positions with tossed frags, the colonel and the point man, taking sectors, advanced across the wide, smooth rooftop above the battle. They reached the edge of the roof and began shooting down the savage indirect fire teams absorbed with annihilating the coalition forces on the streets below. The work was short and merciless. In the course of the assault, one savage indirect fire team, operating what looked to be some kind of micro-mech-based mortar system, detonated one of their own rounds, taking out an emplacement next to theirs, hastening the destruction of the savage counter-assault force massed outside of the bank. Within a minute, the work was over, and Martin and Marks fell back to the building's edge near the roof access and knelt next to the short wall that separated them from the 20-story drop below. The colonel attempted to reach Ogilvy's CIC.
This is Ranger Actual to Doghouse. Objective anchor has been neutralized. How copy? There was no reply from CIC call sign Doghouse. Can't get through to Doghouse, Mark said to Martin.
The point man nodded. The colonel tapped for the sergeant major. Still no reply. Andres had either been killed or was having comm problems also. He tried again, hoping that sheer persistence would succeed. Amazingly, he got a connection. Automatic pulse fire reverberated in the background of a senior NCO's feed as it skipped in and out.
Engaged, sir, but we're hold,
came the reply after identification exchange. The colonel decided his top NCO was too busy to try to connect with Doghouse from his end, but at least he was still alive.
Copy that,
replied the colonel and broke calm.
Sir, Titans, shouted Martin, pointing to incoming Titan bombers sweeping in off the ocean at bomb run altitude.
Titans were massive eight-engine bat-winged UW craft that could be dropped from the underside of a carrier. Marks watched as they closed in on New Vega in perfect formation,
Ahead of them, a swarm of twin-tailed interceptors, engines on max burn, swarmed across the city, streaking in from far to near at thunderclap speed. Ogilvy had gone strategic.
"Get back inside," Mark shouted.
It was their only hope now. They were running for the rooftop access door when all hell broke loose across the city below as a wave of destruction swept toward them. Chapter 32. The wounded Sergeant Major Andres had no inkling at 2 minutes out that a flight of Titans, 8 in all, were about to drop 56,000 pounds of explosives on the eastern side of Triangle Square and up along the hilltop district onto the very nest itself. Most of the bombs in the mix would be high-impact confined radius dumb bombs with a sensor-directed munitions package. But the real kickers were the 4 deep-impact explosive giant bombs called GBs by the UW Navy. These would crater bunkers that had been buried deep, and all 4 were to be used against Triangle Square. Yet even had the senior NCO known of the impending airstrike, it still would not have been the most lethal problem confronting his defense of the main entrance to the First Bank of New Vega. He and the agile Specialist McNeil had fought off 2 waves of savage attacks against the entrance to the bank fortress, burning through charge pack ammo and firing on full auto, but already another attack was coming in fast from the savage lines, and this one was different. It hardly mattered that UW armor and infantry could be seen rolling into the far end of the square. The final push was on. Even with help in sight, the horrible end seemed near at hand. That end took the form of a massive, armored, savage marine, either an enormous human in gargantuan armor or a 9-foot-tall mech. He lumbered across the square, backed by smaller armored savage marines in support, and carried what looked like a flamethrower. Except it wasn't flame it was dispensing, but hot jets of molten metal that spewed forward in unexpected bursts that were almost mesmerizing. A burst of the liquid metal caught McNeil in the doorway, covering him in what looked like molten burning brass. He probably screamed, or tried to, but the heat and molten slag denied him that final act, mercifully cooking him to nothing within half a second. The sergeant major swore in shock and anger as he backed away, swapping in his last charge pack. The savage giant was 10 meters from the entrance when he let go with a molten sprayer again. This time he sent his hot jet of liquid metal right through the doorway and into the smashed and shattered security lobby. Any portion of the walls and floor that was touched ignited instantly, and the glowing orange-red slag oozed down the heavy cement barricades. The heat was almost unbearable, and the position was immediately no longer defensible. Andres heard the trundling servo-assisted gait of the giant coming up the steps to the bank, crushing the ancient marble as it moved, hinges and joints whining with hydraulic sighs. At that moment, he got a flash priority communication override from Combat Information Center Doghouse to every asset on the battlefield. Flash, flash, flash. It was the AI override message, then a voice. GB airstrike inbound. Shelter in place. Seek cover immediately if you are in the open. No one would know it, because the strike would kill the S3 and everyone in the TOC. But the staff officer had disregarded orders and was at least attempting to warn everyone on the battlefield of the impending massive airstrike with a short, terse verbal message that might save some. A moment later, the